Travel Huyuk, and for Turkish speakers, I apologise for my pronunciation of all these names. While illuminating the history of mankind, its art and way of life also raises numerous questions. Forget everything you know about civilization. Places, tools, relationships, diseases, what you eat and drink, your beliefs. In fact, put aside everything you have ever learned about the history of civilization. For Travel Huyuk is going to open up entirely different doors for you. In the history here, art flows not alongside life, but through it. There is no hierarchy, no war, no male-female strife. At Travel Huyuk, there was no hierarchy, for there are no spaces here where administrative decisions could have been taken or areas where such decisions could have been announced to the people or indeed any streets to bring them to such places. There are no signs of a ruling class that ate more or better than the others. Men and women's teeth are worn down in the same way, and the time men and women spent in the house and the tasks they performed were almost exactly the same. They made tools, ground wheat, kneaded bread, and prepared to lead a family. These findings heralded the existence of equality between the sexes. Among the skulls that were passed down ceremonially from generation to generation, or more precisely from house to house, there are those of both men and women, indicating that both sexes could be head of their family or line. Now, this is the publicity blurb by the Turkish Airlines in 2006 for advertising tours to an exhibition in Istanbul about this amazing place, Travel Huyuk. And really, it's a reasonable summary of what we know of this settlement in the Neolithic era, which in Anatolia, and I'll change the thing so you can see the whole map, but this is the area that is we're talking about, which is Turkey today. This is in Anatolia, the Neolithic era stretches from about the end of the Ice Age, about 10,000 BC, to around about 6,000 BC. And Neolithic Anatolia is of particular interest to Marxists because it confirms some of the key propositions of historical materialism. Marx and Engels, drawing on the anthropologists of their day, argued that human society was originally free of class exploitation, and their argument is outlined in Frederick Engels' book, The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State, in which Engels argued that women's oppression only developed with the rise of class society. Now, the idea that humans ever lived in societies free of inequality and class divisions has been hugely controversial over the couple of centuries, reflecting really a general hostility to Marxism and any idea that there could be a future socialist society. And only in archaeology did the idea of social evolution persist all through the 20th century, partly because the different layers of human remains that are embedded in different geological layers of the earth show pretty clearly that human society has evolved through the ages. But also theory has an impact on how the concrete material information has been interpreted. And the Australian archaeologist Vere Gordon Child was very influential, but he was influenced by a Stalinist version of Marxism. But nevertheless, he brought to the discipline a clear notion of human social evolution and also an understanding that the way production is organised lays the basis for how humans interact and the kind of society that they live in. And then the radicalism of the 1960s and the 70s had a huge impact on thinking in these disciplines, and so the basic premises of Marx and Engels were less isolated since those years. And so by the late 1980s, Richard Lee, a prominent writer in the field, could argue quite respectably, before the rise of the state and the entrenchment of social inequality, people lived for millennia in small-scale, kin-based social groups, in which the core institutions of economic life included collective or common ownership of land and resources, generalised reciprocity in the distribution of food, and relatively egalitarian political relations. And today there's an absolute mountain of literature which discusses the existence of egalitarian or non-stratified or non-hierarchical societies. There's all kinds of terminology that anthropologists and archaeologists use because people don't want to use the terminology of class. However, This isn't to say that everything that Engels and Marx wrote, and in particular in Engels' books, The Origins, has stood the test of time with all the new information that's been brought to light, literally by, you know, excavations. And even some of what Chris Harman, the British Marxist, who sadly died just before Christmas last year, he's the author of A People's History of the World, and I think we recommended people have a look at what he wrote. Actually, what he wrote in the 90s is already out of date, and because the settlements that have been excavated in Anatolia have made a lot of previous empirical information quite redundant. However, in spite of this, the new information and the new insights that we have actually strengthen the Marxist case for how society develops. So firstly, what are the fundamental premises of Marx and Engels? Well, their starting point was that human activity to produce the necessities of life is fundamental. And as humans find new ways of producing, they have to organise differently, and so they start seeing the world differently. In the German ideology, Marx and Engels argued, it is not the consciousness of men that determines their being, but on the contrary, their social being that determines their consciousness. But these points have to be understood dialectically. Marx made a fundamental breakthrough in understanding consciousness in his thesis on Feuerbach. In the third thesis, he put the question, the coincidence of changing of circumstances and of human activity can be conceived and rationally understood only as revolutionising... So he concluded, I put this as a question, he actually concluded this, and I'll start again. The coincidence of the changing of circumstances and of human activity can be conceived and rationally understood only as revolutionising practice. In other words, what he's getting at is that activity that changes the world also changes the people involved in that activity. And Marx and Engels argued that society changes because of contradictory dynamics within it. It doesn't have to be impacted from outside. They said, in The Poverty of Philosophy, in acquiring a new productive forces, in changing their way of earning a living, humans change all their social relations. And in a marvellous book, if anyone wants to read about this, called The Leopard's Tale, Revealing the Mysteries of Chattel Huyuk, published in 2006 by Ian Hodder, who is an archaeologist who's worked at Chattel Huyuk on the site from about 1994. Basically, he sums up what Marx and Engels are getting at. I don't know that he identifies as a Marxist, but he says, the increasing use of a wide range of materials, the greater involvement in long-distance exchange, by the end of the Ice Age, all of this requires and allows longer-term social engagement. Objects tie people together in the practicalities of their use. The objects are pursued because they allow greater sociality, but they also mean greater dependencies, material and social, and thus further shifts in practices, concepts, beliefs and orientations. And I think very nicely sums up the dialectical understanding of how people change as they change the way they produce. So the discoveries since 1961 in Neolithic Anatolia actually challenge a lot of old consumptions about gatherer-hunter societies, because there was the idea that they were by necessity nomadic and that settled communities lived from domesticated animals and plants. And you can see, people up the back probably can't see, but Che Unyu is right to the east and Chattel Huyuk is here in the centre, and there's a whole range of other places I'm going to mention. I'll just read their names. Halan Jemi was settled as early as 10,000 BC. Göbekli Tepe was 9,600 to 8,000 BC. Che Unyu 9,400 to 7,000 BC. And Navala Chori 8,600 to 7,900 BC. And all of these are clear examples of sedentary societies that still relied on gathering and hunting. One study of the diet at Che Unyu showed that it was mainly wild game, lentils and vetch, which apparently is part of the pea family. And there's very little evidence of domesticated plants until nearly 7,000 BC. And domestication, I think we'd have to say, only developed quite gradually and often over very long periods of time, stretching out to perhaps thousands or more years, with settlements depending on gathering and hunting to, you know, varying degrees, and each place is somewhat different. So the question arises, why did nomadic gatherer and hunters ever settle in one place? Well, Ian Hodder, though, you know, I've read something of what he says, he suggests that as groups developed more ties and contacts, exchanging goods, meeting for marriage and social purposes, entanglements beyond the small band that in which they moved around in gradually had more lasting significance. He says, we can argue that the first agglomerations of people were closely linked to the sociality of public ceremony, feasting, prestige and status. And from various studies, it is now clear that a central component of the process is that people came together for ceremonies and rituals and to control the alliances that were set up through them. And it was this process, drawn out over perhaps tens, even hundreds of thousands of years, that eventually resulted in the sedentary life which propelled communities into what is now known as the Neolithic Revolution, which is said by many archaeologists to have been the most dramatic development in human society until the Industrial Revolution of the modern era. Now, these Neolithic societies show the developing divisions of labour and the trend towards hierarchical societies actually occurring very much earlier than we ever previously thought our class-divided societies existed. Göbekli Tepe, for instance, the settlement appears to have existed between 9,600 and 8,000 BC, is thought to have been a ceremonial centre with no houses for living in, which suggests that there was a high level of culture and interaction between communities over some distances. And it might indicate the existence of a religious elite, in other words, the beginning of hierarchical divisions. And most importantly, the evidence indicates that there could well have been a social revolution about 7,200 BC, which overthrew an elite in Che'unyu. And the latest thinking is that there could well have been similar revolutions around the whole area, around where Che'unyu is on the east of that map. So let's look at Che'unyu, because Bernhard Brosius wrote an article in 2005 and then more recently published in English, and which was really the catalyst for us having this session, about the Che'unyu revolution, which he argues resulted in the classless society at Çatalhöyük to the west. And he concludes that this rebellion established a new classless society with traditions which lasted for at least 1,000 years. Now, there's still debates about where people came from to Che'unyu, but it's not difficult to see why wandering bands of humans might have settled there at the end of the Ice Age. It's at the crossroads of three different climatic and geological regions, so there's a wide variety of resources from plants and animals to rocks, soils and minerals with which to provide for their needs. And there was plentiful water from the tributaries of the Upper Tigris, for those of you that you can see the map. And as well, its location made it a spot where travelling groups were very likely to pass, so their cultural life and knowledge of the means of producing from natural resources were able to be enriched by others from a wide-ranging area, creating a melting pot of knowledge and culture, which helps explain an amazing richness of the culture that has been revealed in the excavations. Antonio Sigona, who is an academic here at this university, and Paul Zemanski published a summary of the latest knowledge about Neolithic Anatolia in 2009, and they described the houses at the lower layers of the excavation at Che'unyu, i.e. the earliest period. They say they display uniformity of size and plan, arranged around a central communal area used for feasting and related activities that bonded the community. But then, as it develops, there's evidence of the beginning of social differentiation. And by 8,000 BC or so, there's clear signs of a society dividing between those who worked to provide the needs of the community and those who surrounded themselves with trinkets denoting privilege and luxury, but who didn't work to acquire them. In the west of the settlement, they developed what might be called an industrial area, where the houses are all virtually the same, with little public space, but in which food is produced and stone tools are manufactured. In the east of the settlement, There's stores of obsidian, which was a prized hard volcanic rock, which would have been traded from quite long distances away. But there's no signs of it being worked into the mirrors and the tools that it was used for. In the west, in the industrial area, there are no stores of obsidian, but evidence of it being worked up, all the hallmarks of class divisions. And to emphasise this division, there's special buildings which appear to have been used for some kind of rituals. They're described by archaeologists as monumental temples, sometimes as shrines, and they're found throughout this whole area. Sigona and Zemanski described them as reflecting an elaborate cult which was sustained by an organised economy requiring a significant investment of energy by a hierarchically structured society. And in an earlier summary of the findings, Mehmet Ozdogan, who is another of the key archaeologists at the site, concluded, "There is growing evidence that a social group related to the cults and temples also controlled the economy." Now, the art in these buildings has held archaeologists in awe ever since the first excavations, and one writer explains its vibrant symbolism like this: an expression of the desire to control ritual behaviour and the supernatural world in order to control the natural world. Others have written about the needs of such a community to explain and to come to terms with this new experience of sedentary life and the beginnings of domestication of plants and animals. In the words of two archaeologists who described Çayönü, the practices and the architectural structures in which they were performed probably point to social discriminations, to a hierarchical society in which an emerging elite manipulated surplus wealth and controlled what could not be seen, in other words, spiritual life. Now, Sigona and Zemanski describe a crisis which was followed by a deterioration of cultural activities and shrinking sizes of the settlements in the area sometime just before 7000 BC. And Brosius argues that there was a social revolution involving the deliberate destruction of the main cult building in 7200 BC. The building was burnt down, huge columns which dominated a large public courtyard were deliberately broken, and the site was turned into a garbage tip. And after that... But after that, the houses were larger, but they remained of uniform size with no special buildings. Now, there's pros and cons to this argument before we get too excited. There's a seminal argument by Mehmet Ozdogan that I haven't been able to get a copy of. Brosius cites a later article by Ozdogan as confirming his earlier argument that there was no explanation other than that a revolution overturned the existing social arrangements. But if you read the article Brosius refers to, Ozdogan says of the period when this destruction and change occurred, "Possible reasons for this collapse in cultural development are too complex to deal with here, and frustratingly refers to the article I can't get. Climate change and over-exploitation of the land are among the explanations proposed. We suggest that some form of social turbulence may have lain beneath the turmoil." Now, this is hardly an unambiguous confirmation. And in the frustratingly ambiguous phrases which typically sidle around the issue, Sigona and Zemanski discuss the exodus of the population from here and other places and the establishment of a network of smaller settlements, as obviously was a crisis. They put it down to the stress of living in large communities and a desire for a more flexible lifestyle that would be possible in the smaller settlements. But even they do quote other people who discuss the possibility of increasing social conflict. And it's very frustrating reading the material because not everyone uses terms in the same way that Marxists do. And so social conflict, you know, what might be internal social conflict, blurs in the way they talk about it into war, but there is no evidence of war in the period at all. Anyway, strengthening Brosius' case, in a 2005 article, Mehmet Ozdogan discusses this crisis, and there he rejects the arguments which put it down to environmental change. Instead, he says that the movements away from these old centres is so far-reaching that. It implies that some sort of social turbulence must have been the main reason for the motivation to migrate. But then, actually, in a personal communication a few weeks ago, when Osdogan kindly replied to an inquiry that I made by email, he says, "I am almost sure that there must have been some sort of social turbulence by the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic," which is the period we're talking about, "not only at Ceyhunyu, but in most of the core area of Neolithic Anatolia." But again, you see that this is hardly an unqualified, there's always some qualifications, which is to be expected, because the whole history of archaeology, and in particular around the sites of Anatolia, is that new information and new ways of interpreting it, all that information, are developing all the time and coming to light all the time. And many of the And all of the conclusions that were drawn by the first archaeologist who excavated Çatalhöyük, James Mellart, most of his conclusions have been completely revised. Now, but if you read about the Neolithic societies, you do find burning down houses was a common practice from East Anatolia right through to that region into the Balkans. I read an article about the Neolithic in the Balkans where the same practice of burning buildings down occurred. So we might conclude that this example of burning the building was simply the usual burning and burying of buildings that occurred every couple of generations. But in Ceyhunyu in 7200 BC, I think you can say that it appears to be different, because there had been a previous destruction of a special or cult building in Ceyhunyu about 800 years earlier, but then the old building was built over, as was the usual practice. And then it was covered with an elaborate foundation, which in turn was covered with highly polished pink pebbles, which had to be carried by nearby mountains. And this formed the floor of a new grand structure known to archaeologists as the Terrazzo Floor Building, built on the ruins of the old building. And its magnificence was emphasised by this pink floor, which was highlighted by a row of white pebbles at each end. And also, so, you know, it's completely different from turning it into a rubbish dump. But also, at around the same time as the destruction in Ceyhunyu in 7200 BC, there appears to have been intentional destruction and burial of similar unique buildings in Beda, in Navalik, Chori, and a range of other places, in line with what Mehmet Ozdogan said, that he thinks there was social turbulence all through the region. And there clearly was a crisis in the society. And from then on, the large centres regress and smaller settlements appear around Anatolia. Can people up the back hear me? I feel like possibly I don't have to speak quite so loudly. So this brings us to the history of Çatalhöyük, which was settled about 7000 BC in the aftermath of this crisis and possibly as a result of a social revolution. And it's the community described in the tourist brochure in which I started. There was probably about 3,000 to 8,000 people living there at any one time. And I'll just gradually show you. There we go. They seem to be working in reverse order for some reason. It doesn't matter. These pieces of art are like there were plaster figures in that they would make on the walls. And paintings like this with red ochre, and this is another pair of leopards. I'll just leave that there for a moment and regain my bearings with these notes. Because I wanted you to see some of the, you can't really capture it well, but archaeologists obviously find the cultural artefacts in this place absolutely inspiring and fascinating, and you could do a whole talk about the interpretations of them, because the symbolism and the graphic images, the obvious continuation of traditions which were recreated and nourished generation to generation for about 1,000 years is, I think, a tribute to the creative potential of humans, but also to the possibility of a stable, classless society based on urban living. There's no depictions of aggression in any of the art or of disciplinary tribunals such as you see in class society's art, and the art is backed up by an examination of the skeletons that have been found, and no one ever died from violence. there seems to be some continuity with the religious cults from the earlier period, carried into Çatalhöyük. But now they all the traditions are used and the rituals happen, not in special buildings set apart where people live, but in every household, which is why the remains are so rich in elaborate and inspiring work, because it's everywhere and it must have dominated people's every activity. The sorts of things I showed you are just all through people's houses. And Ian Hodder says, we find domestic cults rather than ceremonial or public buildings. Now, apart from the evidence of how religious rituals were practiced, the architecture indicates a society with no inequality in living standards. And if I can work out which way these damn slides are working, I'll go to... Yep. That's a plan of the buildings that they've excavated. And every person has about the same amount of living space, and there's all sorts of complicated rearrangements appear to have happened of how they used storage and burial areas so that larger families use their houses differently to ensure that each, with the same floor plan and structure, every person basically ended up with the same space. And the people are buried in the walls and under the floors. And they bury their houses regularly, about every 30 to 80 years, and then build on top of the filled foundations. And as Hodder wrote, we can interpret this as destructive behaviour, or we can see it as a determination to preserve and honour ancestors and traditions. And the presence of dead bodies buried in the walls and under the floors must have imposed their presence as part of everyday life and consciousness. Now, it's not clear why, but the houses were clustered together. You can see the grey areas are the only public areas. An entry to all the houses was via the roof using a ladder. So there must have been lots of socialising and communal cooperation that had to take place on the roofs of the houses. If you just think about carting animals and food and disposing of human waste, coming and going with materials for making tools and all the rest of the things they did, all across each other's roofs. However, Sigona and Szymanski argue that sometime between about 7000 BC and 6500 BC, at least some buildings were deliberately built down and destroyed, one of which was a shrine, and it was filled with rubbish, which is very reminiscent of the deliberate destruction and desecration in Çayönü. And after this fire, the houses remained of similar size and plan, but they actually have more public spaces and the houses had doors onto the streets. So Ian Hodder concludes after a decade of working on the site. In terms of size, we might call this settlement a town, but it has few of the other characteristics that we might mean by that term. Despite careful sampling of the surface of the mound, we have not found public spaces, administrative buildings, elite quarters, or really any specialised functional spaces except those on the edge of the mound, such as lime burning and animal penning. All there is at Çatalhöyük are houses, middens and pens. It pushed the idea of an egalitarian village to its extreme. It is as much a ritual centre as a centre of production. These various functions are integrated in the house and as a result, there is no large-scale zoning of the town into functional areas. Now, this is quite significant because when Marx and Engels wrote, and until quite recently, we tended to think of classless societies as only really existing amongst nomadic gatherer-hunters. And so it's why these sites, with their tantalising pictures of the material conditions and the ways of living from so long ago, you know, it raises so many questions about what they can tell us about human social evolution. Because being settled is an incentive to regulate the plant and animal sources of food. For one thing, you need to guard against depleting the resources by over-exploitation. Cropping and herding are one area around this, but Hodder actually showed that their settled way of life may have accidentally encouraged domestication of plants. And I'll give you an example later. Because first of all, I want to look at how could it be that people with traditions, no traditions of dominant class, of a dominant class, accept any group lording it over others and living off their labour, which is the hallmark of class society. Now, Chris Harmon says that one of the first groups which could be expected to be freed from labour are religious figures, because first they're believed to actually contribute to production by their mystical interventions into nature. And so they're not seen as not, you know, contributing. And so as soon as surpluses can be created, someone has to manage them. And the evidence from Anatolia indicates that there may have been, you know, particular foods that at particular times were so plentiful they could be stored and kept for when they were needed. But there wasn't such a surplus that it radically changes, you know, general access to food. And so the religious figures could quite naturally become the people who are entrusted with the task of managing first temporary, you know, some temporary surplus, and then as it permanent grows and becomes a permanent surplus. And this is indicated by the existence of the cult buildings as one way the elite emerged. Another way an elite might have emerged is by some lineage or family group getting control of surplus goods, more or less accidentally, because for some reason or other they had access to more productive land, or they might have developed as specialists of some kind, or they may simply have been trusted to take have the authority to take this role. Feasting is thought to be a common way for these lineages to redistribute the extra food that they're in charge of. And throughout Anatolia, there's evidence of areas where communal feasts were held. In Çatalhöyük, there is evidence of the period of about 1,000 years of being classless, there is evidence towards the end of the settlement of the incipient tendency towards a division of labour, specialisation, and the possibility of competition between different groups, probably families or lineages. And in the later stages of the excavations, you find storage bins that have been used almost exclusively for one food or another, indicating, you know, a storage of some surpluses. And it would appear that there were specialists by then in stone tool manufacture. Now, while the production of a surplus is the key to the full development of a class-divided society, the very act of settling begins to change the way people relate to each other. But there's not sort of some straight line of irrevocable development to a class society just because people settle or because they find more productive ways of providing for their community. There has to be a significant social change. And the fact is, really, that most societies did not become class societies until they were invaded by capitalism in the last few centuries. There's also evidence that where divisions did start to become entrenched, many civilizations collapsed, perhaps because of internal contradictions and a limit to their ability to keep developing, but also internal revolt appears to have played a part in almost all of these situations. And it's clear from the evidence that very divided, sometimes quite brutal societies were established in Anatolia by the 9th millennium BC. But around 7,200 to 7,000 BC, there does appear to have been revolts that at least contributed to a developing crisis. And so the evidence of this area has been a significant source of knowledge, of reassessments, which challenge older theories of human development. So before I finish, I want to look at the impact it has on Marxism. Does it undermine or does it confirm the basic Marxist premises? Well, Thomas Paterson, in a book on Marxism and archaeology called Marx's Ghost, says there is a dialectical relationship between theory and practice, and we shouldn't be afraid of new information. He says, while theory informs our understanding, claims of evidence and the fit between them and what is expected theoretically allow us to elaborate and refine the framework we use. And on every question, I would argue, the evidence that we have fits with the fundamental premises of the theory enunciated by Marx and Engels in the 19th century. I just want to look at the two most basic propositions. Firstly, that humans act on the environment in order to produce for themselves. And as they change the way they do this, as they find new ways of producing, they have to change the way they organise themselves around this activity. And this changes the way they think about the world. Hodder, in his book The Leopard's Tale, shows the kind of minute changes which had revolutionary implications over time but would have seemed absolutely insignificant And if people have read Engels' book, he says, all of these terrible changes that brought about women's oppression and class society would have happened without disturbing any individual at any time. So, for instance, Hodder looks at the way the first crops may well have been domesticated and says that it was possibly quite less intentional than accidental. He says that the most efficient way to collect seeds would have been to beat the plants, catching the seeds in baskets, and this perpetuates the reproduction of plants with a brittle rachis, which is the part of the plant that connects the seed head to the stalk. And so the seed heads fall off easily and regenerate. And so regeneration can happen whether there's planting going on, replanting happening or not. But as people begin to use the stalks for weaving, for reinforcing mud bricks, roofing and the like, there was an incentive to harvest, not just by shaking out the seeds, but they began cutting the whole stalk with a scythe, and we see evidence of the use of these kinds of tools. This seemingly pragmatic shift in human practice meant that stalks with stiff seed heads, which didn't break easily, were privileged over the seed heads which snapped off easily. And gradually, over time, there were diminishing numbers of plants with seed heads that snapped off and germinated without human intervention, until gradually they wouldn't regenerate if there wasn't some, you know, the replanting happening. And so then this human, you know, the need for human intervention actually then affects the whole situation and is an incentive to continue the sedentary settlement and to find new ways to keep on producing around the crops rather than to go back to anything about being mobile. Marx and Engels also argued that before the division of society into classes, women were not oppressed, and this is still a controversial idea. Well, I'd argue that with the benefit of new interpretations and advances in science and DNA testing and more detailed analysis of fragments of information that have been retrieved from the layers of Earth, a lot of earlier thinking about all these questions has been discredited, but back up Engels and Marx's position. Some of Mellart's earliest conclusions have been debunked as well. And if I can find that, that's why I couldn't recognise it. That's a skeleton. If you take this, there's a plastered male skull, which was a common practice to plaster the skulls of the dead and keep them, and it's held by a female skeleton. Now, taking into account the context and much other evidence, Hodder concludes that it tells us a lot about the way in which people made specific links between the present and past ancestors, in some way showing ancestry and links through time. And he concludes that this find indicates that there was a central female presence in lines of affiliation stretching through time. And, yeah, this is a representation of, you know, what the skeleton was. But some of the strongest scientific evidence about the relative status of women and men is always looking at their diet. And so Hodder's team particularly went out of their way and searched hard for evidence around this, for differences between men and women. And he concludes they found little evidence of radically different lifestyles. And the fact that all the skeletons had carbon residue on their ribs from spending time in the smoke-filled rooms shows that women were not tied to the home any more than men. In fact, he concluded, overall, there is little evidence that gender was very significant in the allocation of roles. There must have been some differences of lifestyle in relation to childbirth, but these differences do not seem to be related to major social distinctions. He says there was a strong focus on the loss of children by death, which suggests to the modern Western mind a particular role for mothering. But in fact, there are few, if any, clear depictions of women caring for, holding, or nursing children. And, yep. He says, in spite of the widespread use of the term mother goddess, which is based on Mellart's discovery of this clay statuette, there is very little evidence that mothering was central to symbolic life. And there is really nothing in the lump of clay between the legs of this seated woman to suggest that it is the head of a baby being born, as Mellart had first claimed. And so we see that interpretations are changing all the time with new ways of looking at gender. And so it's quite widely thought by archaeologists and anthropologists that in at least some classless societies, now we can see that they had very little idea of gender at all. And the evidence at Çatalhöyük fits with this. Hodder concludes, we have little evidence of distinct roles for men and women throughout the early and middle occupation of the site. There is little evidence that gender was of central importance in assigning social roles, or that there was any difference in dress or lives. Sorry, that any difference that did occur in dress or lives meant that one gender was privileged over the other in terms of the transmission of rules and resources or in terms of social status and lifestyle. However, there is evidence that in these settled communities, which had more incentive for women to bear more children than in nomadic gatherer-hunters, gradually over time representations of women in figurines and statuettes begin to be, by later years, to emphasise women's buttocks and their large breasts, as if emphasising their sexuality, but we don't know for sure what they mean. But we note that Hodder said of his conclusions that he was talking of the middle and lowest levels, which is the earlier periods. In the uppermost levels, i.e. the later periods, gender roles may have become more demarcated as part of wider changes in society. Men and women may increasingly have become associated with specialist tasks and spheres. And so you see, you can trace actually that as the hierarchical societies begin to develop, so the basis for women's oppression is laid. And, you know, we could do a whole session on how that happened finally. So to begin to sum up, I think we can say that there were Neolithic if there were Neolithic revolutionaries, they achieved a more thorough transformation, a much more satisfactory outcome than just settling for reforms. But whether the outcome of the crisis in the societies of Southeast Anatolia and its resolution did involve social revolution or not, I think we can say that the people of Çatalhöyük established and succeeded in maintaining a classless society in an urban, settled environment for a surprisingly long time, between 1,000 and 1,400 years. Ambrosius gives figures about the relative life expectancy of this place and other class societies. He showed that the exploited never achieved the life expectancy of 32, which it was in Çatalhöyük 9,000 years ago, until 1750 in feudal Europe, which is 260 years ago, which I think is a graphic reminder that the benefits of technological advance are negated by exploitation and oppression. I think we can say if there was a revolutionary overthrow in Çatalhöyük and other places, it laid the basis for traditions which guarded against a new elite taking control, whereas simply getting some reforms wouldn't have eradicated the basic inequalities and injustices. But even if there wasn't an actual revolution, Çatalhöyük indicates that the memory of those brutal class societies which had been emerging in Çatalhöyük and other places must have played a role in the careful organisation of everyday life, which continued traditions of collectivity and egalitarianism for so long. House beside house, generation after generation, activities were governed by the same layout and the same symbolism, down to the minutest detail that every house had its oven on the southern wall, and this was free of decoration, while in the northern parts of the house there would be the burials, skeletons buried, and the walls were painted and embellished with the amazing plaster artworks that I showed you and bullhorns, which I couldn't get a good photo of. So however this society came into existence, the thousands who lived in Çatalhöyük showed that a settled, urbanised society could live in classless harmony. And there's some evidence that it possibly took another 1,000 years for the settlement to be abandoned. And so I'd argue that the reason that Marxists should discuss this ancient time is that Anatolian Neolithic society stands as a beacon of hope for the future of humanity today. Mehmet Ozdogan expressed the wonder and the intrigue that these societies hold for those who study them, and it's so inspiring when you read the archaeologists' accounts that they're obviously just so inspired by them. He described what he regards as their outstanding features: a social system that enchanted sharing and distributing knowledge. There's obviously some language thing here because English is a second language, but I thought the word enchanted really sums up the way he feels about it. He says, such an active interaction and sharing of knowledge could not have been taking place under stress or hostility, We do not agree with interpretations such as rivalry or competition or conflict among settlements. Almost all known pre-pottery Neolithic sites were becoming prosperous, and to our knowledge, there is no evidence of either hostility or of plunder. I think the power of Çatalhöyük to touch the imagination and desire for a decent world today has the capacity to displace the despondency and the pessimism induced by 8 decades of Stalinism in the 20th century. And I think this quote from the archaeologist Paul Wason in his conclusions about Çatalhöyük backs up my point, and I'll give the last word to him. He says, to a war-weary century whose own experiments with classless society have failed in the most extraordinary manner, this model encourages hope that something of the sort may nevertheless be possible, at least if it is correctly appraises these societies, both in their claim to civilization and to their classless character, largely peaceful orientation and relative equality of the sexes.